Hi everyone, this is Chris DC. Welcome to the latest in my Nostalgia Interviews podcast. And it was so good to catch up with Celia Pontin. Celia did a PhD with me a few years ago on video games and theology. She works for the Committee for Advertising Practice. And she talks about how for her, a game is a voluntary attempt to overcome an unnecessary obstacle. And that this is the element that makes it fun. She talks about how she drew on the religion and film methodology. And she talks about the interactive nature of video games. We talk about why someone might choose to be a villain in a game and how video games give us the freedom to consider options we wouldn't consider being in real life. We talk about fatalism in the context of fixed narratives. We learn that Celia originally wanted to go to university to do astrophysics and that when she was a teenager, she wanted to be a vicar. And she talks about an essay that she did for her GCSEs on Lord of the Flies, which impacted on the PhD that she was to do many years later. She says that she would be surprised if her son didn't, to some extent, follow in her footsteps. Now, church music has always been the backdrop of Celia's life. She was surprised when she was younger to discover that her friends weren't all into classical music. She talks about how surprised her younger self would be to discover that she prefers reading policy documents, sometimes, to reading fiction. We talk about political blunders in the context of the Millennium Dome, and at the end of the interview, Celia reflects on being in a position of relative privilege. How can it be possible to feel nostalgic about bittersweet episodes? Is there anything that she would change if she could go back in time? And we learn at the very end why Celia is a looking forward person. It was so good to catch up with Celia for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Celia Pontin, who I've known for years and years and years, because obviously you were at the University of Kent and you got a PhD, what, coming up to 2 years ago now?
Yeah, I think it must be.
We were just saying before we started recording that because of lockdown, we've forgotten all sense of time and whole years seem to have gone missing. But in 2019, whenever that was.
Yeah. Feels like a long time ago.
Absolutely. And of course, you were an undergraduate at Kent as well. So do you want to say a little bit about what you do now, Celia?
Sure. Yeah. So now I do something completely unconnected to my degree or my PhD, which is probably the case for many graduates. I work for the Committees of Advertising Practice, which writes the rules for UK advertising regulation, which actually is a very fun job. It sounds boring, but I really, really love it. And I get to do all sorts of things to do with interpreting evidence and figuring out the best way to go forward with stuff.
And it's always exciting because when you started the PhD, you were a school teacher. And then and I have to say, because it's always, you know, they're often very sort of obvious career paths that people follow. And if you're doing a PhD, it makes sense, obviously, that a career in academia is one of the things to consider, but you know, no reason why it should be. But you were actually working for the Advertising Standards Authority, and you were doing work which, although it had nothing to do with the PhD, it kind of also did, because you were dealing, weren't you, with some of the very kind of questions that underlay some of the films or the video games that you were dealing with in your research.
Yeah, so there was a great deal of there's necessarily a great deal of interpretation required whether you are analyzing a piece of advertising or analyzing a video game for academic purposes. So I did get to cross-reference my skills a little bit. But also it's not just to do with the material itself, it's to do with the way that people are going to understand it. Like a big part of determining whether an ad is offensive or harmful or misleading is interpreting how you think people are going to understand that. And that is a lot of what I did on my thesis. So although the two aren't really related, they nonetheless share some characteristics.
Yeah, and do you still refer to the thesis in that regard? Or is it something that you kind of feel that, having spent all that many years on it, that in some way it's a document that you could refer to, not least in terms of the research skills that you put into it, for whatever it is that you go on to do in your present vocation or whatever you do in the future?
Well, I do actually have a surprising number of conversations at work that end up with me mentioning, oh, I did that in my PhD, which is gratifying. And yeah, I mean, the primary relevance for me was always going to be the skills I made, and the subject of it was the personal interest bit. But I can't deny that it's been really helpful in terms of framing my ability to do, you know, academic analysis, and to mainly trust that I have, like, I officially have those skills. You know, I've got a piece of paper that says that I'm an expert in decoding popular culture, basically.
Yeah, and also, of course, I thought you were going to say you've got a piece of paper that gives you a license to watch and play video games all the time.
Yeah, there is that
because
as well.
Because I kind of feel when I go to the cinema, there's always this thing niggling at me that somebody's going to say, "You come rather a lot. This is a bit of an obsession." And I say, "Oh, it's research," and they're like, "Yeah, sure it is, Chris. You keep telling yourself that," and I can sort of, you know, take along a piece of paper or a book or something that says, "No, honestly, this is what I do." But I think you kind of did the same with video games.
Yeah, I mean, it did mean that I could justify the time spent on doing stuff like that to my husband. But it also, the thing is, it's like everything that you start off as a hobby and then do on a more official and formal footing, in that it does sometimes slightly stop being fun if you are required to do it. So there have been games where I've played because I've had to do that to find the end point of an argument for something that I was writing, rather than because I necessarily find it fun. But, you know, that brings with it its own enjoyment and its satisfaction when you realize that you have uncovered something you can write about.
Yeah, because I'd find that if I go to a film festival and I'm told, you know, albeit it's all very paid for in advance, but you're told, right, you've got four films to watch today, this one at 10 o'clock, this one at 12, this at 2, or whatever. And part of me thinks, although I love going to the cinema, when it's my decision to go and there's no one telling me to do it, then, you know, I also can fit everything around my sort of needs. But sometimes you're thinking, these are not necessarily films I choose to watch. And because somebody is telling me that I have to watch four or five in a day, it feels like an obligation. And somehow that the chore that isn't there the rest of the time sort of manifests itself in this very formal capacity. So I guess in a way, doing the PhD, there was, although you obviously loved what you were doing, there must be an element in which you kind of feel that the purpose for which you're studying and indeed watching films kind of sort of gets into the territory of something where the fun element is taken away.
Yeah, I think that's true to a greater or lesser extent. And I mean, as part of my thesis, I uncovered some definitions of what a game is. And my favorite was always that a game is a voluntary attempt to overcome an unnecessary obstacle. And that's what makes it fun. And of course, when the game is no longer a voluntary attempt because I have to do it, does that make it no longer a game because I am playing it because I have to?
And there's always a bit of a journey element, I think, because I think you found it in the PhD, didn't you? Because there was that sense about what the narrator does, what is the purpose of a game, what are the themes that are in there. And although you're probably better off saying what the PhD was on than I can. Not that I wasn't an assiduous supervisor, but perhaps it's better coming from your mouth rather than mine.
Well, the way I describe it to people who have no idea why I would even consider studying video games is that I say that your work was to do with the intersection of religion and film studies, because so people find that palatable, right? Oh yeah, religion and film, I can see how they fit together. So what I tend to say is that I then took your work and replaced every reference to film with a reference to video games, which is, you know, true to a greater or lesser extent. And obviously there are other people's work who I did that to. Particularly Adele Reinhardt and Clive Marsh, a few others. But at a more kind of academic level, to somebody who knows a little bit more about the field, I would say that I was looking at to what degree the interactive nature of video games affects our ability to interpret them meaningfully through a theological lens. So it's one thing to do that to the fixed narrative of a film, where we can have quite fixed interpretations, still a variety of interpretations, but they're more fixed. How you translate that across to a video game, which sometimes are just as fixed as a film, but sometimes have different endings or different ways of approaching things, and also have a greater or lesser narrative than a film might have. You know, can we have the same sorts of conversations? Are they limited, or are they perhaps freed up further? Do they have more scope to have a conversation with theology than a film might?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I suppose in films you can have alternate endings, and you can have things like Ridley Scott is very good at those with the director's cut, and many of them with Blade Runner, and the Alien films, and of course he's sort of made subsequent Alien type films. But it's always really interesting that, of course, with video games, that there's at least the pretense that you're in control, that the player has all these possibilities, and I also really like what you were talking about, the way in which people can sometimes change sort of character, or they can do things virtually through the game that might be the antithesis of who they at least think they are, or want to project themselves as being in the so-called real world. That I think was something that felt really important when you were writing it.
Yeah, and it's something I've thought about a lot when playing games myself. So if I'm in a game where I can choose to do good things or bad things, I find it really hard to choose to be the villain. I mean, I like to think of myself as a reasonably good person, you know, and I therefore find it very difficult to choose the options in a game that mean I would not be being a good person. You know, I struggle with that, but other people quite like the idea of playing with those boundaries and playing with the sense of being someone else, and the freedom to actually take actions in a game world that you would never consider doing in real life, or at least I would hope people would never consider doing in real life. Maybe some of them are playing as the bad person they know themselves to be. But I always think that's really interesting, and it gives you an opportunity to see the consequences of bad actions. Obviously, depending on the game, some of them don't let you. But some of them let you see the consequences of doing bad things and taking poor decisions and being exploitative.
It's funny, I suppose it's like having an avatar, but I go to see films sometimes that, you know, and if it was obviously I put lots of reviews up of them. And of course, there's a certain type of film which it seems that I watch an awful lot of, like 90s thrillers, erotic thrillers in some cases. And I think it's really interesting because in a way, it's not that I'm anything like the characters in that film. You know, I don't sort of look at it and think, oh, I'm just like Michael Douglas or Sharon Stone or whatever it might be. But there's something in those trajectories which are sort of, it intersects in some imaginative way with something either I am or want to be, or other, or perhaps more importantly, trying to figure out other people. Because when you watch those kind of films, inevitably you think, I know relationships like that. I know people who've come into my life, or, you know, you hear from other people, and it's a way of understanding. So sometimes rather than simply think, oh, you know, I will watch a war film or a Western or something, it's good to go outside of your comfort zone, but to identify, inverted commas, with somebody who in some cases might be a very transgressive figure, and somebody who you find repugnant. And I found that with Taxi Driver and Scorsese, that I'd be, you know, finding Travis Bickle or Max Cady fascinating characters, but I wasn't sort of thinking, oh, I want to be like them. But there were things that they did that I found very intriguing, because I'm so different to who they are. But their way, or Scorsese's way, of trying to sort of work out how you deal with questions of justice or vengeance or violence or redemption, I found very interesting. And there were bits of it that I thought could apply to my life. But obviously, the idea that you can take somebody else's life wholesale and then allow that to become your own would be nonsensical. And I think what you're saying is that it's no different when you're playing a video game.
Yeah, and I think it's possibly that to an even greater extent, because you can control them. You're not just watching them make decisions for one way or the other. You're the one deciding that. And I think in some instances, therefore, that can give you a greater sense of almost living vicariously through a character. Although on the other hand, I do wonder whether it dilutes it a bit, because of course and this is the key difference, I think, between truly interactive video games and then films and the less interactive video games. With fixed narratives or with limited narratives, you get that sense of fatalism. You as the viewer can't control, no matter how many times you watch a film, you can't control what happens to the character. So there may be characters that get the comeuppance that you wish they could. There are characters who don't. But no matter how many times you watch it, it doesn't change, even if you're rooting for something else to happen. And there's an understanding and an interpretation that has to happen at that point as to why do I feel that way? Why do I think the narrative should or shouldn't go in whatever direction? Whereas when you are controlling a character, you're making that story. In some games, you will take certain bad actions and end up being told off for it, essentially by the game. And sometimes your character will get away with it. And I guess to some extent, there's a determinism there. But in others where it's a completely open game, you can decide the consequences of those actions. Or whether you even have consequences to them. And that might actually be less fulfilling than watching a fixed narrative.
And I always find it really interesting in terms of your own backstory, because I remember you telling me that you considered doing, was it physics? Or certainly, it was certainly a science-based degree.
Yeah, it was astrophysics I wanted to do. That fell through.
How interesting that you followed, a very different kind of path, but also in a way, perhaps one that allowed you to ask a different sort of set of questions or to ask questions in a different kind of way in terms of the evaluative sort of perhaps sort of part of your brain that perhaps you wanted to mobilize for the purposes of the degree. It's interesting how that came about. So how did you end up studying theology, which of course in itself was the precursor to the PhD?
Well, so when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a vicar. Now, my dad is a vicar, so this idea didn't come out completely out of nowhere. So I wanted to be a vicar, which you would think would lead straight into the theology degree. But actually, I decided that if I was going to be spending my life telling people that God made the universe, I wanted to know how he did it. And so I would do an astrophysics degree. Actually, the original intention was to do an astrophysics PhD, but I was like 14 or 15 at the time and didn't really know what that would entail. But I have very high academic standards. And when I was in sixth form and I was doing maths and further maths and astrophysics, I realized that I wasn't quite as good at it as I wanted to be in order to do this science degree. I could have done it, but not to the standard I wanted to be able to. So I thought, well, maybe like A-level maths and physics is kind of where I stop at this point. And so my mum suggested, and this, by the way, was halfway through sixth form, so I'd already chosen all my subjects and I wasn't doing anything to do with religious studies. And then my mum suggested that, well, given that I wanted to go into theology, into the family business, perhaps I should consider doing a religious studies or a theology degree. And so I did, and I picked up half an A-level in religious studies in my second year of sixth form and ended up at Kent. And like probably quite a few people, in doing my religious studies degree, I decided that I did not want to be a vicar anymore. It was your Death of God course that did it, Chris.
I'm sure you're not the first or the last, although it is interesting, isn't it? Because, and I've said that in so many of the other interviews I've done, that I can stand in front of a class for 2 hours. And of course, nobody asks you. I mean, nobody asks me, what do you think, Chris? Or if you do, I obviously, in a way, I don't think it's necessarily helpful or relevant in terms of what, you know, if we're looking at Bonhoeffer or Barth or Bultmann, in a sense, my job is to kickstart a discussion there rather than talk in the, perhaps in a different way to what we're doing in the nostalgia interviews, when it is much more about the person. But it is interesting, isn't it, that sometimes when you're outside of that zone, so maybe outside of a theology degree, and so when you were thinking of doing astrophysics, the question of faith could come up in a different sort of way. And my sense is always, and I find it at the supermarket, it's so problematic when you're completely immersed in the academic study of theology, but then somebody outside of that will then make assumptions about why you're doing what you're doing, which don't in any way relate to who you see yourself as. And so the question will be, you know, if there might be a diatribe on faith that comes up in conversation. And I find it very odd that I can have those challenging intellectual debates with my students for 2 hours on a Thursday afternoon, as I did with you in, what, 2008? Gosh, it must have been now. Long time ago.
Yeah.
And to do all of that, and then to be completely outside of my comfort zone when somebody will ask me the question when I don't have the same kind of fallback that's available to me in class, when there's a clear curriculum, I know where I'm coming from. I'm at the mercy of the person at the checkout, sort of thing, where I don't quite know what the next question's gonna be like, and I don't have like an answer that's already been carefully developed through years of teaching and instruction. But does that in any way resonate with what happened in your case?
It resonates with what happens to me now, I think, in that if people, I'm sometimes wary about describing my PhD to people I don't particularly know, because there's a sense that if you've been studying theology, it must be because you are a practicing believer, rather than you just find it interesting. Because I think there's an overwhelming idea that the only reason you would find it interesting is because you believe in all of it. And sure, at one point I did, but during my degree, I realized that I had a lot more in common with the theologians that were basically arguing that for the demythologization, I have a lot of respect for Bultmann in that area, who are arguing for the demythologization and essentially to some extent the secularization of the understanding of Christianity. And then I realized why that was, and it was more like, because you're basically an agnostic now. But with that, you know, just discovering that doesn't mean that you don't have an interest in all of the stories that lie behind it and an academic interest in theology. And just because I'm not personally persuaded by a lot of the arguments doesn't mean that I can't have an appreciation for them. And so I think it's a little bit difficult to figure out whether somebody's going to assume something based on the fact that I have a theology PhD.
And do you find in that sense that it's the people who do have a background in theology or religious studies, and obviously you know many of those people who don't ask those questions, but it's the people from a completely different discipline who will perhaps even caricature who you are or who they think you are?
So I've not had that much experience of that happening, but I can totally see that that would be the case. Like, I think that people within our field understand that you can genuinely be interested in stuff, just like you can be interested in history, for instance, without it being a personal thing. You know, it's fascinating in its own regard. I mean, I view it as akin to philosophy. It's asking the big questions of life, and it's looking at what a certain tranche of people hold as the answer to that.
Yeah. And what about sort of, because obviously we're talking about nostalgia, but the going back questions, the childhood, what sort of earliest memories? Because I'm always interested in the way, and it certainly applies in my case, you know, the younger me would never have countenanced that the person at the age of whatever I am now, 47, would be doing what I'm doing. And do you find in that sense that when you look back, are there the sort of the seeds for the, it sounds like they were, certainly if you wanted to be a priest, but the seeds for the sort of things that you're doing now, can you sort of like trace them back and say, oh yeah, that it all makes sense, all the pieces of the jigsaw come together?
Had I remained a teacher or became a vicar, I think the answer to that would have been yes. I didn't even know that my job existed until basically I was doing it, or even that the concept of what doing a policy job meant and things like that. So that was a bit harder. But what I do remember very vividly is an essay that I wrote it was one of my GCSE classes, so I must have been about 14, and we were doing Lord of the Flies. And we've been given various prompts and like titles that we could do, but they're already written for us. But my teacher helped me write one that aligned with an interest I had in the story, which was about a specific character and how he embodied spirituality on the island and the religious imagery that surrounded him, and I think even the degree to which he dies, and provides kind of a narrative impetus for the change in the rest of the characters. And that is basically the same essay that I would write today. And I hadn't realized at that time what an influence it was until it was relatively recently I looked back and I thought, well, of course I wrote that. And that fits so much with what I like to do. And really, it was a precursor to my entire thesis. I really should get in contact with that teacher and basically point out he's responsible for me having a PhD.
Yeah, and that does happen because I was having a sort out on the weekend and I found all sorts of letters that I was writing to radio presenters and said, how do I get on Radio One, that kind of thing, which is what I wanted to do. And it's really funny because although on the one hand, my life, similar to what you were saying, you know, you don't imagine that you'd end up doing what you're doing. I mean, you know, if you said to me at the age of 15 that I'd be working in Canterbury, I obviously knew where Canterbury was, but the thought of working there, living there, just sounded so alien when all my other family members were living in Cardiff. So it just sounded incredible. Congruous. But it's funny that some of those things from childhood, from my teenage years, I still very much sort of want to do, or the interest, the passion has never really gone away. I guess one of the ways of channeling that is through the podcast. But isn't that interesting? So that essay that you can remember writing when you were 14 or 15, it's something that in some way has carried, and you know, the influence has carried through all the way through your adult years.
Yeah. I think I find the video games influence going back further than that. My family wasn't particularly video gamey, if that makes sense, but my dad is quite into technology. We had internet relatively early on, things like that. But most of my earliest memories, so when I was like maybe 5 or 6, are related to video games. Like my brothers had a ZX Spectrum, and I distinctly remember my brother having a book about how to program it to do various things on the screen. And we had some like educational, like really basic at that time, because this was like the early 90s, really basic educational games. But my favorite, and actually one of the reasons that I am drinking from my Lord of the Rings mug, because there is a connection here, is that I remember distinctly my dad showing me the Hobbit text adventure video game. So this is the one where you go through the plot of the Hobbit, a bit like a choose your own adventure book. So you get the text and you have to read what's happening in the scenario and then decide what to do. And I was far, far too young to play it. I didn't really get it and I didn't know the plot of the Hobbit, but it's a very warm memory nonetheless, because he was excited about showing me and it was just cool that he was showing me this thing. And so, you know, even back then, a lot of those memories are to do with video games, even though, you know, we didn't have like the latest consoles and stuff when I was growing up. It was always a bit delayed and we would get them secondhand and things. But a lot of, and like a lot of the best memories I have of my brothers is playing games together.
And it's funny that as part of your PhD, you were looking at those very questions around fate and predetermination, predeterminism, and that whole sense of whether we really are free agents or whether we are in some way beholden to certain sort of tropes or certain ways of doing things, and if we do step outside of a particular comfort zone or character, we return afterwards to the everyday, hopefully having managed to find an outlet for those urges, the violence or whatever it might be. So therefore, unlike in Existenz, of course, where the line is Cronenberg draws a very permeable line, if there is a line at all, between the virtual world and the physical world. But it's interesting that very question of agency is something that you ended up studying in some detail as part of your PhD.
Yeah, and it also makes me wonder, like, what I'm predetermining my son to do.
Yeah, that is an interesting one, because no, same with me and my parents. My dad worked in the railway, and because I wanted to be a train driver when I was young, who wouldn't be, you know? But in many ways, I can see lots in both of my parents and the interest that I have in my grandfather, particularly, who didn't keep a diary, but he always kept a record of what he did. And it was always his ambition to write up his life story of how he met my grandmother during the war and living through the war. And he always wanted to do that. And he finally got around to doing it when he was in his mid-80s, after she died, after his wife of 60 odd years died. And then he managed to do in his final years what he'd sort of intended to do all his life. But I clearly have that same inclination. So it's very interesting to sort of stand and observe yourself to some extent and start to see that it's almost as though genetically, biologically, the things that we do, it's like, well, it couldn't be any other way. I'm just sort of living out facets of, it's very much my life, not my grandfather's, but the things that I do, I've inherited from him. And I don't think it could be otherwise. You know, even if I hadn't started writing a diary as young as I did, I would have found a means to do it at some point in my life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to some extent, that's always going to be the case when you grow up in a certain context. And I would be surprised if my son didn't pick up some of the ambiance of academia that I try and kind of bestow upon the household, probably unsuccessfully. but it is hard to deny that there's a certain amount of not exactly predetermination, because I think that's putting it in too much of the universe's hands. But I think it's easy to understate the influences that upbringing and that family custom and habit can have, because I see myself doing the things that my parents do and being excited about the same things that my parents are, with absolutely no intention of doing that. It just happens. And it does make me conscious about the habits and the customs that I want to pass on to my children, for sure.
Yeah. But sometimes, of course, you if you think about it too much, or if you try too hard, it could be counterproductive, or you could just end up being bitterly disappointed, because there's a part of me that wonders, because I've got four children, and I think the chances are surely at least one of them will end up, for example, keeping a diary. I mean, they may not, why should they? But I've done it. So there is a chance that one of them, and I think, which one will it be? But of course, I could be so surprised, and it could be, you know, and it may be none of them, or maybe one of them will have a career in, say, radio, if there is still radio,
there will always be radio.
But one of them could end up doing the thing that maybe I never did but wanted to do. So you kind of see your children living out the kind of life that you wanted to do, but they're just, you know, it's the right time and place for them with the appropriate nurturing, etc., from the parents. But there is that element. But I think the mistake is, you know, you sometimes hear people say, oh, my child's going to go to university and do this and do that. And they may well do that. But when people are sort of already saying what their 7-year-old's going to do, or yes, say my 8-year-old is going to do maths at Cambridge or something, you're like, well, you know, they may or they may not. But sometimes it's tempting fate to sort of, you know, use a term that we've already introduced into the conversation to try and imagine that will happen.
Yeah. And I definitely don't want to place any of that kind of expectation on my son. Like, as long as he manages to find something to do that he finds fulfilling and that makes him happy, like, sure, if that were academia, I'd be delighted. But equally, if it's not, and if he finds his place in the world doing something completely different, then, you know, cool. Yeah. That's fine by me.
And apart from video games, or indeed perhaps that is actually how you want to answer the next question, but things from childhood, like for me it was music charts. I was obsessed with music. That was what we all talked about in the playground. Do you have similar kind of memories as well about the sort of cultural influences that kind of defined a particular school type experience?
Not necessarily in terms of school, but in terms of upbringing, the kind of the background to my life has always been church music, for incredibly obvious reasons. I was the vicar's daughter. I went to church every Sunday. And then when I was old enough, I joined the choir. There was always that in the background of my life. So my parents were primarily into classical music, especially my mum. So I wasn't really ever into chart music so much as a kid. Like, I used to hear a bit of it. And sure, when I was a teenager, I started picking up a lot more in terms of that. But I've always felt at home with things like, you know, Handel's Messiah and stuff playing in the background. Like, you know, that just feels like home to me. And the same with, you know, church hymns and stuff, just because I don't really, well, I was about to say just because I don't really believe the words, but actually most of them are theologically unsound anyway. But, you know, there's always going to be a huge part of me that finds comfort in those from the just the familiarity of them.
Yeah. And how did that set you either apart or with many of your peers? Because did you find that you had interests that dovetailed? I mean, was it a case that you your friends all had similar sort of interests, or in that sense, was this something that was a bit more you, and you didn't necessarily need to share that with anybody? How sort of idiosyncratic was that growing up in the 90s or whatever?
Well, because I grew up in a small village, and even for families that aren't particularly practicing, the church is still to some extent the heart of that. Several of my friends from primary school were in my local Sunday school. Some of them were even in the church choir for a little while. So it was kind of, it was fairly, you know, I wouldn't have said they had the same relationship with it that I did. I do remember going to a friend's house once, and I can't remember why, but I was looking through like the CDs that they owned and being really surprised that they didn't own any classical music. But when I was a bit older in my teens and I was more into jazz and big band music, then I found people who at that point were more into that as well, because I was playing in like school jazz bands and music groups and things like that, and always around the music kids who I had more in common with. That's not to say I didn't have that in common with others of my friends, and you know, my best friend at school is how I know who, you know, people like the Ramones are. You know, there was still that disparate sort of influence, but I was never much into the charts and pop music per se. It was always exciting when the slightly countercultural pop punk people that I was really into were on Top of the Pops. You know, it was like, oh, they've reached the charts. Well, good for them.
Yeah. Any particular artists that you have in mind? You mentioned,
God, who was I into? I'm not sure I want to share my teenage musical
day. Well, don't. Far be it from me to try and get somebody to disclose something they don't want to.
No, I was into, I was really into Avril Lavigne. Oh, God, that's shameful. And Blink-182 and, you know, bands like that who were just, in hindsight, thoroughly unmusical. And considering, like, my classical music upbringing, I really should be ashamed. Whereas now I set more store by the actual musical and songwriting talents of the artists that I listened to. But it was, you know, it was fun and it was really expressive and emotional music in a way that I didn't think that chart pop was, and that, you know, I could get behind it on a more emotional level, which, as you know, a 15-year-old is really important.
No, and it's funny, sometimes I find that I'm constantly going back to stuff that you know, circa, it's always particular ages, so like 1982, when I would have been 9 or so years of age, that sort of music is so utterly in my DNA that, you know, it was even yesterday, I even felt the need to post this on Facebook, because I thought, what is this song? And it's a 40-year-old song. It's actually Cliff Richard, of all things. And I thought, where has this come from? It's not even a song that I know all that well. And it just somehow, because I was obviously exposed to it 40-odd years ago, somehow it is there, it's latent. And it's almost like Dionne Warwick is another artist who's the same thing. It's almost like suddenly it emerges. It's almost like you know this song. It's not unfamiliar to you, but it takes 25 or 30 years or more sometimes for it to suddenly to find expression. And I kind of feel very comfortable with that, in a way that, you know, you might look at it and say, well, people, you know, might think, oh God, that's really naff music, or but you think, but it doesn't matter. It's because there is something so ingrained about that. You either pretend it's not there, or you don't, you know, perhaps you don't want people to know that your musical taste might have been, like, you know, really sort of out of kilter, or you just say, actually, because of the passage of time, this in itself is so interesting that it doesn't matter whether it's cool anymore. It's 40 years old. It's a different generation. And there's something more interesting about how you make that thread. You find that thread from being a 9-year-old to being somebody in the late 40s. And you kind of feel that along the way, your own identity, your own personality can be tabulated, can be mapped. And I find that quite comforting.
Yeah. And I mean, the older I get, the more I have sympathy for my teenage self. And I imagine that's just the consequences of growing up. And it's now more than half my lifetime since I was 15. So that's quite comforting in itself. But I do find sometimes I have that impetus to turn on the music that I used to listen to. And it's still, you know, I still view it with fondness, even though now I it's not like Cliff Richard, where it was, you know, I'm not really a Cliff fan, but I can see why people were, and it's good, solid music, even though it's of its time, whereas some of the stuff I listen to just does not age well. But I still have that fondness for it because I remember how it used to make me feel. And I think that perhaps it was the obvious countercultural option for someone in a small Lincolnshire village at the age of 14. You know, that you would be listening to pop punk because it was the available alternative. And I think that now I listen to stuff that is more of, you know, it's not odd or different in any way. It's just not pop. And it's the idea that, like the start of the idea that I don't have to listen to what everyone else is listening to. It's fine if I don't like it. I don't have to make a thing of it. But there are other options out there. And I think that was a juvenile way of expressing that.
Yeah. And I've just suddenly remembered that you used to go around with a guitar, didn't you, at one point?
Oh, yeah, I did. I did, because I used to do open mic nights every week.
Oh, in Canterbury?
Yeah, so it was in my... That must have been in my second year, I think. And to some extent in my third year, I was involved in running some open mic nights that I think were on the same evening as the film, religion and film classes that you would run. So yeah, I would probably turn up to those with the guitar.
I think that's what I remember, because yes, you're right, because we had the Death of God and the religion and film, and it was always on a Thursday afternoon. It was like from 1 till 6. Yeah. But we had to go from one end of campus to the other in between the two classes. And that's right. And it would be your guitar that you'd be carrying with you from one lecture to the other. Because we should have drawn on you, because for 5 hour, I know some of the people are in the same class, but we should have had a musical interlude. I think I missed the trick there. I think
You were not missing much. My musical skills weren't all that.
Yeah. But what about, I mean, things like at university? Because one of the questions that because obviously I interview a range of people, but sometimes it'd be like, you know, anybody who, you know, because you did enter academia, obviously in terms of your degree and your PhD, but in terms of, and we've already covered your subject, but you know, you're someone who, well, like me, who went to university and kind of stayed, or certainly found the reward in doing subsequent degrees, and of course in your case you balanced the teacher training, and then, you know, you very much wanted to do the PhD. That was always your goal. But what were the main kind of inspirations to do all of that? To do the, you know, you mentioned school as being one thing, and talking to a teacher and the influence of the teacher who taught you Lord of the Flies. But you know, was there a sort of a moment when you thought this is what I need to do?
I think that probably came during my degree. So I went to university because that was what you did. You know, if you were lucky enough to have a decent education and the support of people to go, and you were, you know, reasonably academically talented, then you went to uni. It's like there was nothing else that I would have thought of to do. And so, you know, I kind of went out of the sense of that, you know, that's the next step in life. And then I think it was during, my second year that I figured out that I actually, something clicked with religious studies, and that I found a great deal of satisfaction in, particularly the links to media and to pop culture. So I did courses on film, on music. There was one on, I think, narrative or literature or something. And I found those all really rewarding. And it was during my second or third year that I started kind of seeing the shapes of some further work that I would like to flesh out to do with video games. I think it was even, I seem to remember talking about it at the reception for my graduation. I would have gone straight into doing an MA and then the PhD maybe as a full-time thing. But by that point, I was moving to London with my, or near London with my partner, and I couldn't really justify staying in Canterbury. But I still ended up coming back and doing it. So that was, it was nice that I managed to fulfill that in the end.
Yeah, it's nice when all of that comes full circle. And I guess also in terms of some of the religious questions, because I know you were involved with the Lambeth Conference, which, of course, to date remains the last, not the last as in last ever, but the most recent, because obviously the pandemic has put that on hold for at least another year. So in that sense, you were involved with that. But politics, religion, sport, film, you know, is there anything from the university years that you can look back on as well as academic study and sort of feel that that very much defined those days?
Nothing specifically in terms of the hobbies I had. I think the inspiration came from doing the work itself and the subject itself. I liked seeing the connections to media. And that's something common to the, you know, the non-academic work that I do at the moment. I like tracing the connections between things and working out where various topics and media intersect with each other and the ramifications for that. So it's more almost inspired by methodology rather than subject, which is a really nerdy thing to say, I think.
But yeah, although obviously you're in good company, because I always remember a student who may have been maybe just after you, a couple of years after you, but who said I have a confession to make. This was in a tutorial. She said that she's a religious studies nerd, and I thought, do you know what, that's, you know, if that's not a bad confession to have. In fact, actually, you know, well, isn't that great that you're actually doing a degree in an area where you kind of feel that these are the interests you have and you want to let them unfold, let them develop, let them flourish, and to be proud of that and to be able to sort of be very confident and comfortable admitting that. And I think that's an interesting and important journey where, you know, I'm often finding in the teaching that sometimes I know that the students are there because it's about getting credit. They're there to get their 30 credits, and that's fine. You know, they're there because they want it. They know that in getting the degree, it gives them X, Y, Z options later in life. And if they weren't doing my course, they'd be doing another course. And maybe, if I'm honest, as soon as they leave the lecture room, they're not thinking about the stuff that came up in the class, and that's fine. But there are always others who, and I think obviously that would include you, but who do find that those questions do stay with you. And of course that, and also that's more exciting in some ways, because it kind of means that when you're at a lecture, because, you know, sometimes people give me an odd look when I say, hope you enjoy the lecture, or hope you found that entertaining or whatever, because it's like, oh, but you know, entertainment and education, of course Clive Marsh talks about that very thing in his work, but I think in that sense it just gives you more options. And actually, if there's a synchronicity between the content of the degree and the type of person you are, well, you're going to flourish. Whereas if you just say, oh, I'm doing this because, you know, my teacher or my parent or indeed I did it because there were no other options available, and, you know, I'd exhausted all options and I, you know, did this out of desperation, well, the chances are you're not going to really enjoy your university days. So in that sense, you've got a very sort of good narrative, and it's a very convincing and one that where it all kind of ties together.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. And like I was saying, kind of towards the beginning of the conversation, I do see the links between the skills from my degree and my PhD and the tracing of the connections between different subjects and, you know, a media and theology, for instance, they have resonance for my work in policy and finding analogies for things, in understanding the links between how advertising of one subject works and how advertising of another works, and all of this. And it's something I find fascinating. And I don't think I would have believed you when I was a teenager if you said that I would be more interested in some regards reading non-fiction books about public policy. I mean, like pop public policy, you know, written for a mass audience, but that I would find that preferable in some regards to reading fiction. You know, I love a narrative. It's why I like video games, but I also love uncovering deeper knowledge about subjects and how you can use that to think about others. And I feel very lucky that that's meant that I have been effective in doing my degree and my PhD and now my job.
And it's also kind of nice, though, that I think everyone needs it, where, you know, great if the degree corresponds with your interests. So, you know, if you're doing a degree in religious studies and you know that there are sort of church or whatever interests that sort of go on, that's all good. But often it's always nice to have a bit of a counterpoint. And I find it interesting that in my case, although I do read novels, I don't read as much as I'd like to sometimes, but I'm always like reading diaries of politicians, and it's often like people who were politicians in at the time when I remember them in power, and then you see the disjunction between what the time, you know, the on-message things they'd say at the time when they were in government, and then what they then afterwards say, well, I almost resigned, or I really considered my position because, and that's the interesting bit, because that's when you try to, at the time you're thinking something about here doesn't check out, but you know, how would you know? Because politicians are often, you know, a good politician's going to be very careful not to say anything really, really daft. And the ones who say daft things often perhaps don't always have a very long shelf life. So isn't that interesting that sometimes it's the things that it's almost like a glimpse into a life that isn't your own, but it connects sufficiently for you almost to be able to say, you know, I was at university when that happened. And, you know, at the time I wasn't persuaded, or maybe there was a general election. You were thinking, you know, which party do I vote for? And then it's nice years later to go back on and see that campaign through a very different, perhaps more honest, but also arguably blinkered lens, because obviously that campaign is not being fought anymore. And you know what the outcome was. So, of course, that person's narrative is very much clouded by what did happen. Where at the time, there were two or more sets of alternatives, and they had the power to influence how people should vote.
I think that's particularly the case for me at the moment, because I'm at that point where you in your life where you understand just how politically naive you were as a, you know, as an undergrad. Not all undergrads were. I was, and I didn't necessarily understand the import of what they were saying, because there was in my third year was the general election that led to the coalition government, and I think now I would have so many more opinions on that and so many kind of ideas of, well, what does that mean for this policy area? And part of that political education is because I have to know it for my job. I have to know and have an opinion, or at least some kind of idea of what's coming down the line related to the work that I do. And it's meant that I learn more about it, but also the consequences of those decisions. So you talk about the campaigns that did or didn't quite come off, or the promises that were made, or the scandals that happened. And as somebody whose job is to make policy, we see not political policy, but self-regulatory policy, it fascinates me looking at the analyses of those sorts of decisions. I've actually got a great book that is very long and has been half read for about 4 years on my bookshelf, but the bits I have read I've really enjoyed, called The Blunders of Our Governments, which is about things that have happened and kind of looking back at them and saying, well, why was this like potentially a colossal failure? Or I think the bit I finished before I put the book down, meaning to pick it up and never did, was about the Millennium Dome and how that, like, it's very much turned itself around and now it's a venue in its own right, but how that was a politically difficult thing to happen. And you know, I remember going there as a I think we went there on a school trip because there were a certain number of free school children places, I seem to remember. Like, I was in year six at the time, and that was all very exciting. And as a kid I was like, isn't this brilliant? And then as an adult reading that book and looking back at the politics of it and why it was promised and what it was supposed to be and the timescales and its legacy and all of that is a really fascinating kind of double look at it.
Yeah, and of course nostalgia played a big role in that, because I remember Michael Heseltine, when he was in the Tory government up to 97, obviously they had to plan for the millennium well before, and he was, and I think he had to persuade the then John Major cabinet that this was worth doing, and he had to also seek assurances from the incoming Labour administration, not that he admitted that, you know, would admit at the time that Labour could possibly win the election, but in order to secure funding for that. But that was a big nostalgia journey, because I think I remember him talking about 1952, and was it the big celebration, Festival of Britain? There we are.
Okay.
And it was all this sort of thing, and it was all about, he remembered going to that when he was a young man, and it was all about then, you know, how interesting. But that kind of backfired, because that sort of sense that somehow the millennium was going to be this moment when people saw this seismic moment in time that they'd lived to see, the point where one century became another, and that's obviously not something that most people ever get to do. But I remember as we entered 2000 and the artificiality around it, and the on TV you'd have all these big stars like Michael Parkinson or Michael Burke, and you know, people who were sort of like, were all plucked out to sort of present the Millennium coverage. But they kind of, it all felt so synthetic, because what they were really celebrating was just the clock turning to 12 o'clock. And it didn't really feel that they were trying to make that the news rather than there be a news event that they're responding to. And because they were trying to sort of do that over the period of, you know, a 12-hour broadcast or whatever it was. And it just felt very, not fake, but it just felt as though they were cashing in on something. And you know, what the Millennium meant somehow was never, nobody ever really got to the heart of it, and quite what we were marking and celebrating something and going down the pub and having an all-night sort of drinking session, but we weren't quite sure why, and it didn't feel very personal, certainly not in my case anyway.
Well, in mine it did a little bit, because like I said, I was I was 11 that New Year's Eve, and my parents made a bit of a thing of New Year's Eve. So we had some of our extended family around, and then a couple of family friends, and made, you know, a small but nice and active party about it, and set off fireworks and things. And of course, because I was 11, this was a big deal. And it was because you get to stay up till midnight. New Year's Eve was always a much bigger deal. I don't really mark it now I'm an adult. but I think, were I doing something to do with the Millennium now, then I would be thinking about things, which I think was the part of the intention of the Millennium Dome Project, would to be looking at the things that have been developed in the preceding century and making imaginative forecasts of what could be, and, you know, what's in train at the moment in terms of technology, you know, medical technology, robotic technology, and what's happening. And my recollections, which, you know, this was 20 years ago, of the Millennium Dome, was that was sort of the point of it. I seem to remember there were some aspects to do with that, but I would make, you know, the broadcast of the celebration of the Millennium much more about, well, what's happened before and what can we expect and what can we hope for, rather than just, oh, there are zeros in the year again.
You know. Yeah, because you're right, because the Millennium bug seemed to be like, that was the story, because it looked as though it was almost like imagining what the news could be, that suddenly all the computers would stop working and then electricity would stop. And suddenly the country and the world would grind to a halt. And then there was a certain narrative, and the government would have to have somebody in play. I think it was Margaret Beckett, who was like going to be the Millennium bug kind of principal spokesperson. And in the end, of course, we look back and laugh at that, really. But at the time, it felt like it was almost as though, because we were entering this new millennium, that we were going to get into some kind of Matrix type reality that we were going to, from which we were never going to extricate ourselves. In reality, God, it was a bit more boring than that.
Well, that's because I'm sure I've read this somewhere. I might be making it up. This might all be complete rubbish. But I'm sure I read somewhere that actually, in reality, software engineers were just not bothered by it at all, because, of course, they'd noticed it was going to be an issue. Like, it wasn't that 3 months before December 31st, someone thought, oh no, the clocks are going to, you know, computer clocks are going to be based on something else and this will be a big problem. No. I'm also sure that I read that the bigger issue was ones where there's a clash when it comes to binary numbers, which means there's a specific year that actually seems completely random to us, but actually to those who work on it is much bigger problem than the year 2000. I can't remember the details of that. But, you know, to think that people are going to not consider the fact that dates change just seems bewildering, that as the public we would ever think that.
Yeah, and you're right, and the whole period running up to 2000 was sort of, and I think it did feel that it was trying to fuel a story that never really happened, like the one would become a two, you know, people would have to remember to put the two at the start of their date rather than the one. And you look, think, well, yeah, that's true, but who doesn't write a checkout? Well, who writes a checkout anymore? But, you know, for years I'd always write a check or sign something, and at least for the first half of January you'd always put the previous year's date, and then you get something sent back from the bank saying, you know, sorry, this is, you know, you'd say, yeah, it's obvious what's happened. But I suppose on that thread, as we start to wrap up, Celia, sort of, and actually it's funny, we're talking about nostalgia now, very interesting if I was doing this sort of project around 2000, because then at least it felt that it would feel that it would have a certain sort of currency rather than something organic, which actually is kind of the way I like the fact that this is coming about. It's not because we think we ought to be talking about this, because it feels the right thing to be talking about, certainly in terms of me with the podcast at the stage of life that I am. But would you say, looking back on your life and career, your memories are predominantly positive?
Oh yeah, totally. But like, I'm in a position of fairly remarkable privilege, you know, and I've had a stable family upbringing. I've got a stable family of my own now. I didn't have the very best of education, you know, I didn't go to private school or anything, but I had a good comprehensive state education. I went to uni. I could be supported through that by my parents. I've got a decent white collar job, you know, I've got all of this going for me. And so it's hard to even think of a time where I was particularly struggling or have many negative memories at all. Sometimes I look back and I think about my teen years at school and I realize that in hindsight, it wasn't that great a time, like socially or whatever, but you know, I can't really complain. I had it much better than some other kids. Yeah. And even when I think about decisions that at the time maybe I regretted, I think about where the broad strokes of my life story have taken me so far. I couldn't be happier.
Yeah. And actually, you touched on the word negative there. And I think that's the interesting thing, isn't it, about nostalgia? Because I suppose nostalgia is a kind of pining for something which is not so much even about, and it can be about rebuilding the past, but it can also be a case of there's something missing now. So I think nostalgia is much about the present as it is the past, or maybe even the future, because it's about, like we were saying about the Festival of Britain, it's that sense of trying to sort of impose in the future something that kind of represents, encapsulates something that was meaningful to us, you know, decades in the past. But you know, can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
So, you know, I think to some extent you can, if you're already feeling melancholic. So there's like a particular few weeks. It was right at the beginning of my second year of uni where I just moved into my first ever student house, but it was before term had begun. And it was your typical Canterbury early October, late September weather where it was getting dark really early and it was constantly drizzling and murky, which I quite like. And I can't remember exactly what was happening. There was some, you know, I was 19, there was some social drama happening, and I just remember there being some, you know, slightly unhappy context to that couple of weeks. And so whenever the weather's like that, I feel nostalgic for the way I felt then, if that makes sense. Like, it reminds me of it, and I kind of feel almost pining for that in a way, because it was also self-contained and it was sad but cozy at the same time. And there's like this almost tinge of romantic, oh, I'm a student and life can be difficult but bittersweet at the same time. And so I'll always think about that kind of fondly, even though it wasn't technically the happiest time.
Yeah, and I think the same with me, because having a diary is an interesting corrective against the tendency sometimes to over, you know, eulogize or over praise or over condemn the past, because the diary is a record of what happened on that day rather than if you see it 20 or whatever many years on. But you're right, I'm the same with those university years. There's always something for me, exactly the second year, sort of around 92, 93, that there's something stuck in time almost about that, that that's always my go-to default sort of, that was, and in reality at the time, if I look back on the diary, of course I was always anxious about, you know, the next essay and, you know, the idea that somehow it was this unblemished period when everything was wonderful. But I'm not sure that that's even healthy as human beings necessarily, because we need, you know, challenges can sometimes make us productive, and it's like, okay, there's something we need to work with. Was, you know, for me, it's very easy to think sometimes, of course, you say, oh, you know, it's a busy old term, I can't wait for a holiday or whatever. Then, but in reality, not only does work never stop, because, you know, term ends, there's essays to mark, and then you've got, you know, moderating to do, and then the new set of essays and courses to teach. But also, when you're on holiday, it can feel very anticlimactic because, this may be about me, but I'm not somebody who could just, you know, lie on a beach or something. I kind of feel I always have to be doing things. So it's always that sense that as long as you're in control to some extent of what's happening and you're not finding things overwhelming, that being challenged is actually a very productive thing. So I'm often nostalgic about times in my life when I was super busy, but I was on top of things. So I look back on them as being very creative periods. I wouldn't be nostalgic about a time when I was bored or didn't feel that there was anything really exciting going on.
Well, I do have a very distinct memory of at some point in my third year of just really wanting to be done with uni so I could start my proper life, right? So I would have this freedom and I would be an adult and I wouldn't be beholden to essay deadlines. And it seemed like some kind of utopia. And now I think back and I'm like, I would love to be back at uni again. I would love to have the freedom to pursue your education in various modules and things like that. And just to have the time to just be doing academia, but also exploring like the university societies and hobbies and just having time. And almost feeling nostalgic for that, whereas at that time I was actually feeling kind of antsy and wanting to get back out into the world. And it's not so much that I'm looking at it in a rose-tinted way, because I know that's how I felt. It's more that I think you see the pros of the other situations and want to diminish the pros of your current situation.
Yeah, no, I think that's brilliantly put. And I think that it's that awareness, because the danger is, you know, if you went back in a Peggy Sue Got Married type scenario to those days, you know, I wonder if you'd necessarily feel that it was as amazing in that sense as you've and also you've moved on as well. So is that sense that you have to relearn all the things that you'd already learned organically and spontaneously the first time around? You know, in that sense, it's not necessarily the most creative way of flourishing.
Yeah. And sometimes I do think about, you know, how like every so often you'll come across a film or maybe just an article that asks like, oh, what would you change if you could go back? I don't think I'd change anything. I mean, sure, it would have been sometimes I think, oh, I wish I'd done a science degree or an engineering degree. That would have been really neat. And I missed out on having a STEM career. But if I hadn't have decided to do theology, I wouldn't have gone to Kent and I wouldn't have met my husband, because we met in our second year, you know, and then I wouldn't be here in a house that I love and have my son. And, you know, there's just, and I wouldn't have the job that I do now that I really love. And I wouldn't want to do that whole going back and changing things thing. It doesn't occur to me.
Yeah, because it was even at the time when I started doing the podcast, there was still a part of me that needed to go back. And I thought, you know, there was something about that, you know, those magical days, you know, and I was fascinated by that. But also, although in many cases I've met so many of the people from that era through reunions, etc., it just means that things are a bit more textured. And what you also do is you realise that this is terribly important and you're glad you've made those reconnections. But also sometimes you see the downside and that, you know, you can study nostalgia, but also like with anything else, like a film, you're studying it critically. Or Christmas doesn't mean to say that you think Christmas, you want to live Christmas every day. You can also find that sometimes, and that was probably the reason I studied it, that I found it as annoying and frustrating and irksome as I did amazing. And I think it was that paradox that I wanted to explore. And I think as long as you're aware that something, you know, you don't have to sort of see something in a very binary way, then actually you get more out of it, I think, in that form. And actually it leads on to my very last question, Celia, which is whether you are a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Well, at this current point in my life, I think I'm very much looking forward. And that's partly because I have a 2-year-old and I'm always, you know, that makes you think so much about the future because they grow so quickly and I'm wondering what's next for him. You know, and we moved into a house that needs stuff doing to it, but in an exciting way. And we plan to live here for, you know, the next 10 years or whatever. So that's kind of very forward looking as well. And then there's a lot to look forward to. And I'm also, you know, occasionally I look back to things as you know, when you're kind of falling asleep at night and suddenly you're reminded of something terribly embarrassing you did when you were, you know, 18 or something. that happens, but I'm finding that the older I get, the more I am able to make peace with that. So I don't need to look back as much to kind of think about things that trouble me about my life, you know. And like I said, I feel very privileged to have had the life that I've had so far. And a certain amount of looking back is reflecting on that. And that I've been fortunate, and that my life choices have led me to somewhere that I'm very happy with. So I don't tend to sort of look back and long for the days when, because I'm very happy with how they are now and how they are shaping up to be, and how I hope that they will be in the future. So I'm kind of looking more towards that and trying to lay the foundations for a good future.
Yeah, that's wonderfully hopeful. So no, what a
Thanks.
wonderful way. What a wonderful way to end our conversation. Celia, thank you so much for being my guest.
Oops, all right. I'm glad to have been your guest.